Well, hello. My name is David Schmidt, and I'm here today with Joseph Atwell, and we're going to have a conversation on this January the 16th, 2021. Good morning, Joe. How are you?
I'm fine, Dave. How are you?
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. We are facing certainly a challenge that is comes around only rarely in history, and this is an enormous challenge. We're facing a challenge of information war, and so it's epistemological, meaning it is a challenge of knowledge. How do we know how to interpret this information that is being flooded at us? And thirdly, it's a prudential war, a war of wisdom. So there you have it, three stages: information, knowledge, and wisdom. And we need to develop some new skills, some new ways of dealing with this, both as individuals and cooperatively.
Yes, I agree completely. I think the key piece of knowledge that starts everyone, you know, in my opinion, toward clear-mindedness is recognizing two things. One, that the government has been taken over by a malevolent secret society. And two, that what they give us as news, as facts about our world, is very often propaganda for the purpose of, slave control, basically. I mean, I'll give you the example of 911, wherein, people could just see that, the buildings collapsed due to, planned demolition, controlled demolition. But the government just forced this idea that it was these terrorists who got lucky. So I think that's just a good platform to look at all of our world with, is the idea that the government is lying and the government is using propaganda, so we can't think clearly about them. I think COVID is, now it's the same kind of propaganda structure. People can see that the disease is certainly not as damaging as the lockdown is. The lockdown is destroying lives en masse. It's also, creating misery. And, of course, it's also applied slavery because, of all of these extreme and weird restrictions they're putting on us. And they're telling us that we can't think about them. We can't think about the government. We can't think about their motivations. Instead, we just should be afraid of the virus. And of course, this is leading up to the vaccinations that they have prepared for us. I'm very worried about these, and I'm glad I'm here with an august biologist. That would be you, sir. Because I think so many people just are not thinking about, well, certainly not about the disease, but in no way are they really wondering about the nature of this so-called vaccine. I have spent a lot of time studying it, and I will just say that it is just the case that once this gets into your body, there is just every real chance that you start expressing your genes, start expressing these, supposedly replicants of a coronavirus. There's a woman named Professor Dolores Cahill who points out that, well, down line, those aspects, these things that are being expressed because of the so-called vaccine that you've taken in, could be seen by the body as viral material, and then you have the body turn on itself. You have an autoimmune disorder take place. And there's nothing you can really do other than try to treat it as best you can, because it's in, once it's inside your body, it can't get out. Once it's affected your genetic material so that they will always have the potential to create this replica that they've designed of the coronavirus, parts of the coronavirus, so supposedly so they can create that the body will recognize it and then create an antigen so you'll be prepared in case you ever do get the coronavirus. I mean, Dave, boy, it sure looks bad to me. If you start out with the idea of malevolence in the creation of the coronavirus story and of the lockdown, you really have to be very suspicious then of the vaccine. Would you agree with that?
Well, certainly. And I don't know how much of an august biologist I am. Maybe an aghast biologist.
No, you're aghast.
The kind of large thematic problem with the way this mRNA virus works is that, unlike the traditional vaccine where you're introducing fragments or attenuated, weakened viruses or fragments thereof into the body to provoke the immune response, in this case, you're actually instructing the cell to make these parts of the virus and then to present them, to display them on the surface of cells. And so you are stabilizing these parts of the virus. You're giving it a residence, so to speak, in the body. And we just do not know how long these might be there, especially when we don't know what kind of mechanisms can go wrong in terms of that RNA being back engineered into DNA, so to speak. And that can happen if a retrovirus picks it up. So far we don't know about much about that, but it certainly is not outside the realm of possibility. And we're being hoodwinked here a bit with this rush to the vaccine. And it's not just the government that we have to worry about. In this case, government has fused. I mean, we're in the era of all kinds of chimeras, you know, all kind of monster creations, yeah. Not only at the molecular level, like with these viruses, but at the super organismal level of institutions like government and corporations, which have fused to take on properties that really make them not only more powerful, they have gains of function, just like the gain of function research in virology. They have a gain of function, which is the ability to use both lethal force from the government side and also to coat themselves in the protection that a private corporation has. And so their employees, the customers, the citizenry in general, the population of the world cannot resort to such things as constitutional protections when a corporation doesn't need to particularly abide by things like free speech. So that is troubling. And we talked in the first podcast about this fusion of all of these sorts of information systems, governmental, biological, communication, entertainment. They're all being melded into a very concerning conglomerate you know, we're always accused of you, of being frightened people. So I'm not particularly an easily frightened guy, but I believe that I'm rationally concerned about what seems to be, emerging here.
Yeah, because they have the, you know, this idea that, well, we're here to help you, but they're here to help us by setting up a slave state. They're here to help us by giving us vaccines, which we're clearly not subjected to the necessary trials to be certain of their safety. So you have to be, you know, troubled and wondering if whether or not what we're actually looking at is just the sophistry of people who are trying to enslave us and genocide us and are using, you know, this kind of clever distraction so that we don't ask the straightforward question of, well, you know, is this something that's evil?
And so I look at medical literature and then secondary types of websites where physicians and scientists are discussing these things. And I've tried to contribute, and, you know, comments are simply not even posted if some reviewer considers them to not be supporting the narrative. So here we have a cutting off, a blockade of critical information. And, you know, sometimes now we have to go outside of the traditional experts to look for other intelligent critics, people maybe with economic insights. The good ones in that realm are certainly numbers people, and they can at least look at the epidemiological aspects of these things. I'm thinking of also something appeared this week at the Mises Institute website by Bill Sardi, suggesting that it looks like we can see that the deaths due to the vaccines are exceeding by a large number the deaths due to COVID itself, even given the tendency of the government and the pharma industry to exaggerate the deaths from COVID.
Right. And which in fact is a scandal unto itself, because they've got all sorts of mortalities, which prior to this definitional change that they made last March would have been just simply pneumonia, heart disease, diabetes. That all changed to create this appearance for propaganda purposes, in my opinion, of, you know, this really catastrophic or supposedly larger number than would otherwise have been for the COVID. And when you compare the real what I would call the real death rate of COVID to what's going on with the vaccines, it's dramatically worse, because you have to separate out probably 95% of the COVID deaths under any circumstances. And so now you're left with this very small number of deaths and a very large number of deaths from the vaccines. One bizarre excuse that I came across was one government official who said, well, the reason why so many people are dying from the vaccines is because we're giving them a lot of the to old people, as though that somehow is an excuse as to why they're dying.
Right. So leave the old people alone. I mean, well, yes. Take care of them in the normal ways that you take care of them.
Yeah.
But don't be giving them the vaccine.
Yeah. So anyway, this is, I think we're in that, like you said, how unique this time is that we're in. And I agree with you. I mean, this is sort of like when Rome wanted to implement the Dark Ages. I mean, this is, you know, we can look at this as an attempt to establish, a perpetual slave state, and also one which, you know, has intellectual stratification. I mean, you know, this is really grim. It seems to me like one of the goals here is to dumb down the population. You know, I mean, this, you know, the toxicity and just all of the different ways which if you start thinking about how did our world get into this condition, you know, a lot of things just pop up as, you know, curiosities and things that have to be kind of wondered about. So we really.
Sure. Just last week, in fact, as an example, I was talking to a mother and father, and there was their son was there too doing his homework, and they said that, you know, he was sent home for 2 weeks. Do you know why? He coughed once in the classroom, and the teacher made the assessment that he needed to be quarantined. So remember how in our first talk we were talking about how in the Moderna and Pfizer protocols for testing the vaccine, they didn't use the word diagnosis. They used the words confirmed and adjudicated.
Yeah.
As though these are really political and judicial determinations. So they removed this whole process from the lab bench and the hospital bed. To the bureaucrat's desk and the judge's bench. And because this involves education of our young people, we have young people now who've gone for a full year, without education to speak of. And these online, you know, these Bill Gates, online learning things are just not adequate. They are not a substitute for the other types of people-to-people education.
And I think, again, I would think that the right kind of concern about this is whether or not this is part of the deliberate plan, because basically that what you're describing is something that is the dumbing down of our population. And there is no real justification for it. It's just, you know, the bureaucrats are saying, well, we have to do this to keep the kids safe. But Dave, the statistics are very clear on like how dangerous the virus is to children. It doesn't have any effect on them at all.
Right.
So now the question is, well, why are we locking down the children? You know,
right. And you know, one practical little tool that you and I have been talking about is developing a system of alternative testing. You know, for instance, I pick up the local paper here, and there are constantly headlines, every paper, regarding this explosion of cases, quote-unquote cases, here in the county. And you just don't see it on the street. Now, it is true that older people are on occasion going to the hospital and sometimes dying. But I've worked in hospital. That is what happens quite frequently in the winter, is that you have the elderly and infirmed coming in with the likely pneumonia.
Yeah. That's right. So what we're looking at is just a very well-controlled propaganda system that is justifying this and confusing people and making it just a plausible argument that, you know, we need to keep locked down. There's some benefit to it, even though, you know, Dave, if you start looking at the rationale, I mean, if you look at it longitudinally, you can see that it's just sophistry, because look, they said at first we had to be locked down for 2 weeks to flatten the curve. Well, that was why we gave up all of these rights and ended our businesses. But that didn't work, obviously, right? Here we are. Where are we now? They're locking us down every single month. There's more, you know, criteria of the lockdown. Well, the lockdowns aren't working. And at the same time, the fatalities of things that they had, you know, frightened us with are now pretty clearly just, you know, it's there is no way that the effects of the lockdown are not worse than the damage caused by the virus, no matter how you want to cut it.
And it's part of their sophistry.
Yep.
Their rhetoric was that we needed that lockdown in order to, even if we didn't in the long term reduce the number of cases, we at least would spare the throughput through
right.
our
overwhelm the medical system, which somehow
is that they're closing down floors because they're turning off the elective surgeries and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And yes, you know, you lay off a bunch of nurses and doctors, and guess what? You're going to have a shortage of staff.
Yeah, which is anyway. So, you know, the when you look at it from the lens of their, you know, propaganda, it even under that criteria, it's starting to fall apart. But then, if you put in some skepticism into someone's thinking, well, good heavens, now it just becomes as clear as a bell that what we're dealing with is just a project by the government to enslave us. And so, yeah. You know, now the question is, well, what to do? How do we respond?
Right.
You know, I think that one thing that's really important is to set up cells of information where people can exchange information and support one another against the government. I think, you know, you had mentioned that you're in communication with, you know, some young people in this regard. You had an idea here?
Right. So a university student contacted me regarding a group that they're forming at their university, and they want some assistance with that. This is a thing that we see kind of sprouting up in a number of places. James Corbett did a report recently on something they're calling freedom cells.
Yeah.
And so, see, I mean, that's what's positive about this experience is that it tells us that people have an inherent structure in their mind of a cooperativity that enables them to overcome all of the abusive propaganda that we've been exposed to, not really for just decades, but for centuries when you follow it, its philosophical roots deeply. But, you know, these ideas of exaggerated or hypertrophied individualism, you know, that makes it almost impossible during good times, during the fat times, to get people to cooperate. And that's all done. That's all done through the movies and academia and journalism to constantly reinforce the idea that the natural way is the lone agent, you know, the lone rider. So that's good that's occurring. And people are realizing too, as they begin to make attempts going beyond just thinking about things, and as they start to move in the direction of taking action, they realize that we need not just voice. We certainly need voice because that's been damaged. But at the same time that we develop voice, we need to also develop power, real political power. The two have to go together. Just like individualism and cooperativity have to be balanced. They both have both sides of these dipolar realities have important features, and we need to use both. And so this is very, very encouraging. And I think we can also see, maybe we can talk a little bit about this, about what such a kind of cell system is, because a cell by itself is not even really all that important. It's when the cells become linked together with sells really around the whole nation and even the world.
Yeah, I mean, this is the hope of the future. We have to, I mean, you know, if you kind of think of what is the structure we have to create now. I mean, just say you're at the point where you realize we're dealing with a malevolent secret society, that there is some conspiracy. And I just wanted to digress and point out Catherine Austin Fitz's statement about conspiracy that she made last week, where she said that, you know, in regards to people denigrating conspiracy theory, she said that the operating principle of the economics of our world is the conspiracy of the oligarchs.
Yes.
This is what all humans have to suffer with. So the idea that you can simply dismiss something as irrelevant because it can be described as a conspiracy, I mean, this is one of the key things that they do to control us, is to put that idea into our heads. But the fact is that Catherine Austin Fitz is correct. That is the most important aspect of the force in this world, is the conspiracy of the oligarchs. So we need to stop this the denigration of the idea of like conspiracy and try to develop more skills in determining conspiracy. And this will be very useful. The reason I brought it up here is that when we develop the cells, when people start creating these like committees of public safety, to use an expression, I think that comes from the French Revolution, which is not necessarily something I want to follow, but it's just the concept. You know, these committees of public safety where people start to organize themselves into groups, you know, it has a tremendous advantage in that it can't really be controlled or repressed by government when it starts this kind of natural eruption, very small, you know, cells. But when it transitions into political power, you have to be very careful, because here they'll try to put someone in charge of it. That
right.
is an actor, someone who will pretend to be, you know, on our side, but is really, you know, their agent, and we just aren't aware of that fact. And I would say, I know this is maybe sounds weird, but I've been actually asking that this process become common for years, is that if we're going to end up with a few leaders of the resistance, they are prepared to have DNA tests, so that we know what their background is. Because I think very often, you know, you get individuals who are, they pretend to be things which they really aren't. For example, right. they pretend to be Christians. So I really would like to have, I mean, even though it's imperfect, even though it can be manipulated, I don't see why there's any reason to not at least have that as a criteria. In fact, I would say that, it should be done with every political leader at this point, because if we had power, because you can't trust any of them. And what we need to do is to have information come to us that will identify the secret society, identify the conspiracy.
I think what you're asking for is that it's a step towards ensuring whether they have ulterior allegiances or underground allegiances that don't immediately appear at the surface.
Exactly. Now,
and one of the things that is nice about this cell model of organizing citizens, let's just talk about the structure a little bit. So imagine a group of, 5 to 10 people. This has been around, really, this concept as a recognized concept. It's been around for a long time. Churches have done it. They are these, you know, whether Bible studies or like a men's or women's support group, all that sort of thing. And, you know, the size of about 5 to 10, even 10 is a bit large. Seems to be about the right size for interaction. And it probably goes back to deep origins of humans themselves, whether it's hunting groups or the women working it with the children and preparing food and clothing and that sort of thing. So back to the larger organization of the cells. So imagine you have this group, essentially handful of people who meet regularly to keep informed, to calibrate things, people's common vision, so that and any type of hysteria or kind of irrational speculative hyper suspicious thinking doesn't take hold. That's essential. But then it's important for them to communicate with other cells. So if you imagine that every person is sort of encouraged, not everybody can do it, everybody differs in their ability for this, but, you know, the people in the groups are encouraged to interact with one other group. So you see what this does is it each person potentially becomes a sort of divalent link. They link at least to one other group. So if you have six people in a group and they're each linking to one other group, you now have seven groups that have formed a part of the net, and so on with each group. And that can spread very rapidly. And in fact, it can be really an alternative mechanism for distributing even printed material and ideas. Just think of how quickly among children jokes pass, you know? I mean, a joke can make its way across a whole nation very quickly, you know, when children tell it to their neighboring children. Or I think of even before the days of electronic communication across Europe, there were towers with signalmen at the top. And one signalman would receive a message from a tower in one direction and then convey it to the next signalman on the next tower. And you could get a message across Europe fairly quickly that way with towers that are in line of sight.
Yeah, and that's a great analogy. And we need to have that kind of communication set up because there is a potential for either an end of the internet or a complete, you know, repressive control over it that would make such a communication impossible through the internet. I would say that the one of the goals that should be, you know, understood about these organizations, these little tiny microorganizations, is that the one of the key, if not the key, purpose would be to help the group go through the process of thinking about the propaganda. In other words, for example, we have the situation with the vaccine coming up. If we had these organizations in existence right now, they could take the analysis that the government is giving and attempt to compare it to analysis that other people who are skeptics are providing, and then make their own decision as to whether or not this is a safe thing for them to go forward with. That's the kind of purpose that I can imagine these groups really coming to the assistance of very, very quickly, because right now, this isn't something, Dave, that is out in the future. I mean, this week, people are going to be given choices in terms of the vaccines, or whether or not to take it. And I don't think anyone can argue that there has been an adequate information, given to the public about the dangers, about the lack of how much testing has been done relative to the need for the kinds of testing for something that has the power to be so damaging and so genocidal.
And some of those people will have compromised capacity for choice.
Yeah.
People who are in convalescent homes and what have you. You know, there's one thing before we leave the topic of cells.
Yeah.
One other beautiful thing about the cell structure as a way of receiving information and processing it, right? Because it's important to think of these cells as also being like a sensory system, a brain system, and a motor system, right? Well, one of the beautiful things about them is that they're horizontal. They really don't have inherent in them a hierarchical structure. And it's not that I'm against all types of hierarchies, but when you have a bureaucratic hierarchy form, this is something, this gives a handle which allows people with malevolent or nefarious intent to grab hold of and to control organizations. So there is, in the network model of organizing these cells, a resistance to that. It's hard for superstructure, an oligarchic superstructure, to somehow gain control of that. And the other thing is that this network, this organization of humans communicating with each other, it lacks the aspect of conspiracy, which in most definitions of conspiracy, there is not only people talking together and organizing together, but the notion of criminality or malevolence being involved. So it's the cell and network structure is transparent, it's horizontal, and also if it is damaged in places, you're damaging a network that really is multidimensional. It's not simply even as like a simple fishnet, that it has a multidimensional structure to it that really makes it resilient and resistant to that type of outside interference.
It resists top-down propaganda just by its very nature, and it encourages freedom of thinking. Because when you have so many people participating in the thought process and communication with one another, you're going to get lots of ideas.
And you disincentivize the tendency of human beings to self-censor out of fear of being punished in the top-down structure.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And so, you know, we're really also in an interesting time when we're going to have to revivify or re-energize or rejuvenate the capacity of citizens, to engage in the intellectual aspect of being a human being. And
yes.
I said this, I think, in the first or second podcast, intellectual activity is not just for people sitting on a riverbank in Paris with a beret smoking unfiltered cigarettes and talking about philosophy. The intellectual life is something that every person has not only a freedom to do, but a duty to do, a duty as a citizen to do, to use whatever gifts they've been dealt and to exercise their capacity as a human being to think and to learn. And so I think this structure will incentivize that very human need and part of our identity, really.
Yeah, and it's that's so well said, Dave. And what we're saying, need the response to this worldwide effort by governments who are clearly organized to give information which is false and to demand compliance to slavery. What the correct response is to have everyone, have all of us, change our thinking concerning government and also of the world itself. We have to actually look at ourselves as, you know, well, how do I organize myself? How do I approach my day, my world, myself, in terms of the best, clearest mind I can have? Because this is such a revolution, understanding that the government isn't, the governments are in conspiracy. It requires a different kind of approach to being a human being. And yeah. So we need to really start to energize ourselves, to activate ourselves, and to make sure that we become just an impossible to control group of humans, that the vast human race does not simply comply, that compliance is not seen as a value. But in our circumstances, compliance is seen as the greatest sin a human can commit. From now on, we only do things that we understand, and we vet everything. This has to be we have to change from the beings that thought that the government was reflecting our interests to beings that see the government as something that is in opposition to them, is organized against them, and we need to think about everything that they tell us and everyone who they give us as, you know, as a potential leader, with more skepticism, with more, attempts to analyze the potential for, for damage.
Right. You know, I don't want to go into it in great depth. There's more developmental work that needs to be done, and probably I should put it together in print form, really. But I'm working on a sort of alternative forensic method, you know, if you think about the debate society from college or something. And so this could be, I hope, a tool, I believe, too, a tool that at least can have some purchase in places, maybe among university students or in town hall meetings. It's a way, I think, to better get at a more thorough analysis of questions that are before people. And, I liked what you said about, compliance. And so an act of compliance, for adults should really, for adults and for citizens should be one of deliberate, deliberation, responsibility and voluntarism. And it should occur at the end of a very active, active period of research and examination. And, I recall when I was working in a regulatory agency, sitting in a yearly audit with federal and state officials, and it came my turn to describe my aspect of the program. And I made the comment that never in the years that I had been working there, had I ever, with the regulated community, had I ever, in a conversation on a telephone or in person, had I ever used the word compliance. I never, this was a common buzzword, you know, to always be talking about how are we going to make people more compliant. And I made the statement in the meeting, and the meeting went silent. Everybody, just stared at me in horror, you know. But
yeah,
really,
because you're against the great narrative of our existence, you know, which is that without compliance, all of these government agencies just become, they become exposed as, as have power to damage us, you know. So,
yeah. And you know, so I mean, I'm a practicing Catholic. We both have Catholicism in our childhood upbringing, and you know, this is one group who, for whom compliance, obedience is it's sort of built into us, and so I think we need to take it. We need to have a serious discussion about obedience. You know, people will quote a chapter from Romans about, all the power of the sword coming from God. And so, okay, we do understand that as human beings, we need to achieve certain purposes. We do that with organization. Government will always be with us to provide us some protection and those sort of things that governments can do. But they always need to be subject to the will of the citizens. And so in order to do this, we have to move towards a real examination of the vice of malignant obedience. And you know, the features of malignant obedience, you know, the willful ignorance, willful acceptance of merely fragmentary assemblages of evidence, where critical evidence is being hidden in order to craft or manufacture a false narrative. We have to develop a nose for smelling that, and also the courage to respond and resist it.
Yep. Well, one thing we really need to apply this modality toward is the condition that Professor Dolores Cahill, I believe is her name, was mentioning in a podcast last week. I thought of it, at least I saw it last week. And she was saying that, you know, when you have the RNA vaccine en masse, you know, we have millions of people inoculated, she believes that you'll start to have fatalities. Which we already are seeing, of course, you know, but she's suggesting that if you start having really high body counts, we need to have independent autopsies, because she says that there is a way to distinguish between people who are dying from reactions to the vaccine. In other words, they are having the autoimmune response to, the effects of the RNA vaccine, rather than from COVID, because she is concerned that the government will try to define these mortalities as COVID mortalities and then use that as the rationale for mandatory vaccines, because we are now facing the situation where there are, you know, a high number of people dying every week. And so she says that we really have to think clearly about the causes of the fatalities if we get in this situation. This would be a great moment for this kind of organization to really come into its own, is when people start seeing the alternative explanations of the deaths. And instead of like complying with, by taking the vaccine, which they were worried about at the beginning, now they will be even more concerned about it, and more able to think clearly and get their own information, vet their information, and then share it with other groups that they can connect with.
Right. You know, one of the problems is, it's not an insurmountable problem, but one of the nasty aspects of being alive in the present system, capital S system, with all of its tools of creating a medium. It's not just a media. It's a one big unified medium. Some people call it a matrix. One of the problems is that they have control of all the powers of research.
Yeah.
So, and so we need to vary. We need to quit this kind of anti-scientific trope that we have of you know, it's reactionary on our part, and it's understandable because we've been abused by a misuse of science. But we ourselves need to really embrace science, which is just a methodological way of asking questions. We need to embrace that and to use that as part of our cause, part of our army, if you will, of information and knowledge and wisdom. And in order to do this, so what I'm talking about here is we need to rebuild our we need to rebuild society, because they've captured all the institutions of society.
Right, so, and they've captured science as well. Science has been weaponized.
Yeah. So I think that across the board, that includes law, it includes science, it includes the communication arts, it includes art itself, history. History is a tool of an actually history is an intellectual discipline really devoted to conspiracies in large part. It's a large part of what it examines. So I like to talk about something, just for lack of a term, I call it the second society project that we have to devote ourselves to. It's a long-range goal, but every general in a war has to devote his attention to both short-term and long-term goals. And, of course, they have to be prioritized at the level of tactics. But we also need to develop these long-range goals as much as is possible, given our present situation and the present demands and our need to respond to incoming missiles, so to speak. But we need to develop these long-range plans, because that is what energizes the people in the short term to act, because then they can start to see the telos, the end, the compass point that we're working towards. And it also means that when they have that vision of something better, it'll never be perfect, but something better, much better, something that we've even had to a greater degree than we do now, when they can see that, then it requires much less bureaucratic organization on our part, because people simply hold up their compass and see what direction north is, and then they can begin to even autonomously as individuals see in a given situation which way they need to go without being told, without checking some kind of thousand page document from the central planner,
yeah,
even
and,
if there are central planners.
Yeah, and when the cell system is working properly, we will be able to get information we can trust, because it'll be coming from this large vetting process. You see, we can trust a vetting process that includes everyone. It'll produce good ideas, things you can trust. We won't need to rely on, malevolent scientific talking heads to give us our understanding of reality. We will be able to trust the information more completely, and we'll be able to act on the basis of it. We'll be able to say, no, we're not taking the vaccine. We know there's too much risk that you haven't disclosed to us.
I'm going to sound like a crank here. I just want to interject. We don't have to listen to pseudo-scientific talking heads.
Exactly. Yes,
because,
that's right.
Because when they I mean, science really is a method, but of course it has a body of information behind it. If you're going to do biochemistry, you have to know about molecules. If you're going to do medicine, you're going to need to know about anatomy and physiology. But really it is, it should not be treated as an authoritative source. Rather, good scientists, just like good historians, good political philosophers, what they should be trained, what we should think of them as people who are trained to ask questions in a very rigorous way, just like what we want at the level of the citizen interacting in these groups, using hopefully better forums for doing that. Well, these people should also, given their talents, they should be very aggressively and rigorously combating ideas with each other.
Of course, and I mean, science is not afraid of discussion.
Right.
And science is not something that is used, correctly for intimidation and for demanding compliance from the citizens. Science is there to help us understand stuff. And
right.
We really need to revolutionize science to right. take it back so it becomes a process by which the public can benefit and not one that can be used to enslave.
Right. A scientific discussion has a strong, strong horizontal nature to it, not a vertical nature to it. And it's not a military system, a system of military hierarchies is what I want to say. And
yeah.
It's true. Okay, so it's the job of a mentor in a university to train students, whatever discipline it is, students who are not able at the outset to communicate with a community of professionals. But it's the duty of that mentor, the dissertation advisor, what have you, to bring that student up to the professor's level so that they can use terminology and concepts and creativity to interact in a more peer-to-peer way with professionals. So to horizontalize that vertical, what is necessarily a vertical structure of initial education, to horizontalize it so that they become exercised in lateral discussions.
Yeah, I think right now the thing we really need from righteous scientists, people who would hear our words and agree that the concern, is justified, that they have they interact with courage. They need, because they're going to be, going against the peer review domination, the threats of, like losing career momentum. I mean, all of these things are going to be hurled against them. But this is a time for courage. We need more people who can bring the righteousness of science to the public to stand up. There is no way that, something like an institution like the AMA should ever have permitted, without just bloodshed, the government bringing out something as potentially damaging as the RNA vaccine without enough testing. I mean, the right. fact that you didn't have just explosive reaction, alerting the public to the danger and demanding the government, go forward with a public process that everyone can understand over a sufficient experimentation, which in this kind of a vaccine would probably be generational, for heaven's sakes, to make sure you're not really wrecking people's genes. That just shows that the AMA is an organization that's controlled as part of the propaganda. It's something that's owned by government. So we need scientists to stand up in opposition to these kinds of government structures and start connecting people back But supporting people in their concerns, that they are not crazy, they're not stupid, they don't need to be browbeaten into submission by some, you know, talking head who is a doctor. They know that this is a legitimate question, that there are people on both sides of the equation, you know, some supporting, some in opposition, and they have the requirement to use their mind as best they can to make an honest decision.
Right.
And so this is, I think, a step we need to take, and we need to take it quickly, Dave, because let's face it, they're going to try to roll the vaccine out. One piece of good news is that there have been tremendous resistance against taking the vaccine. I know here in my community that they're actually struggling getting hospital staff to take it. In California, there have been many hospitals where they just can't get, a large fraction of the hospital staff take it. And this is a triumph of the independent media. This is exactly the process that you're describing, where there's so much information now coming in cross current to what the propaganda is saying, that people are saying, look, I don't know. And because I don't know, I'm not going to take it. You can't make me. Well, this is what we need to expand upon.
Yeah. And as we're getting towards the close of this segment, this is sort of my hope for the long-term goal that we're working towards, starting with the cells, is to develop this parallel society, really a society that we've lost in large part, to rebuild that so that we can have in parallel formal discussions, mirroring the institutions that we've lost. And the people that can really contribute to that would be, in many cases, these people who are retired or who are independently wealthy and secure, people who can be the they can run a blockade for younger individuals who necessarily need to protect the direction of their careers. We understand that. We want them to be we want the younger people to be interacting with those sources of knowledge until we can reestablish those within our own community of activated citizens, so to speak.
Yeah, that's such a good thought. Do you want to encourage people to reach out to you who might be fitting in that, by those definitions?
Yes, that'd be great. So right now, I mean, they could find a way to communicate with me through my website. Or through the podcast link and the Patreon link, but I will also rejuvenate my website. I'll commit to doing that quickly here, so that they can find me through that mechanism, and then we can start the discussion.
That would be great. That is really a righteous program, Dave. I mean, I hope it's, hope a lot of people take advantage of that, because it's what we need right now.
Yeah. And, one group that can really, really help us, and they have a lot of skill in doing this, would be attorneys. For instance, imagine, just as in law schools, they have mock courts. Those are things that could be happening right now, independent bodies of attorneys or other professionals in their philosophical societies that once existed, they could be examining the issues of the day. Certainly scientists as well. They could form independent committees of medical and disciplines that would mirror the CDC and could take a look at uh, these these sort of things without incurring the risk of, you know, each individual scientist or lawyer or whatever being called, you know, a loose cannon or a nut.
Or losing their ability to make a living, you know.
Right. Yeah. So that's that, you know, that, and that will open up something for a future discussion, which is we need to really rebuild our banking system, a banking system that works for our people, you know.
Yeah. Well said, Dave. Well, anyway, let's thank you very much for such a great discussion, and we'll do it again soon, I hope.
Good talking with you, Joe.
Good talking with you, Dave. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. All right, bye-bye.